graceful alcoholic. Hi, folks. This is certainly a very inspiring experience for me. I work every day with fellow alcoholics, but I don't often get the chance, privilege to address a conference such as this. It's very gratifying. Thank you for having me. As I sat tonight having dinner with two of my good friends here in this area, Dr. Av and Carolyn, I wondered, you know, as I always do before a meeting like this, what is it going to be best to talk about? So I had this talk prepared, and when Av and Carolyn came along, I turned it all over on the back, and then I got a few notes here. I said, tell your story. And then my good friend Bunny came up and said to me, tell it like it is. I'll try to tell it like it is. That's difficult for me because the richest experience in my whole life is the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suppose the first great event in anyone's life is that he's born, and the last, knocking it off, is when you pass out, leave here. And some say getting married. Well, I was certainly put in this few great experiences. My membership in Alcoholics Anonymous started in November of 1948. I really can't do justice to the feeling I want to convey about what this fellowship has done for me in every area, all over. Everything about the program has been a revolution in my life. And I'll die with this program in my heart and on my lips. And God forbid if I should die any other way. When I came here tonight, I had something in mind. I was telling my friend Gene over here that I had some kind of a talk ready, having thought through a few things at dinner. And then I came in and I saw this motto, sobriety through unity. And I got a thrill from it, and I said, we can turn it around too. It's unity through sobriety. Because you see, if there's one single thing about our fellowship more than another that's impressed me over all these years, it is this. That AA has never asked you and me, really, to break our habits. It has never asked us to make a violent change in our life so that we become other people, but just to become the people that we're capable of being. And to try to find the things, I've always said, to try to find the things in sobriety that we thought were so beautiful when we drank. So I like to say we stopped drinking. I certainly did, for the same good reason that I started. I had to come into AA and to practice it over the years this way because, you see, the old way never worked. The one big mistake that I made in the 10 years from 1938 to 48 in my struggle with booze, the big mistake was the fighting of it, trying to control it, trying to use willpower. And then it hit me when AA came along. It hit me very forcibly that AA didn't have much to do with willpower. Nobody talked much about that at all. And then in my own way, a light went on, and I gradually discovered why willpower doesn't do. Willpower is no good at all for us because we do not have any habit to break. Now, if that sounds like a con to you, I don't mean it that way at all. I mean it like it really is. Because, you see, I did stop drinking for the same good reason that I started, and that was to feel good. I think when you drank, like me, you drank to feel good. Now, many fellow alcoholics said, well, I never had a fun period. I got into trouble right away. I got drunk, and it was in jail and trouble and wrecking cars within a few weeks. Others of us perhaps were luckier, and we had a fun stage to go through. But when you boil it all down to one simple truth, every one of us drank to feel better than we were feeling when we were sober. And so, we drank, I think, to feel good. I read a lot of literature yet. You know, I'm interested, of course. Booze is the center of my life. I read and study everything I can see on it. And I have to respect a lot of serious efforts that people make when they say, we drink because we're lonely. We drink because of some difficulty with mummy at the age of four. We drink because of some physiological X factor, and on and on. I don't know about all those things. I only know that I drank to feel good, you know. I might have been lonely, and I drank, and I wanted to feel better. I might have been with a party, and everything happy with friends, and I drank to feel good. So I don't think loneliness is the reason. I don't think the relationship to my mother is the reason. I think I wanted to feel better. I wanted to feel good. Now, feeling good is a curious, mysterious experience. That's why I'm coming around to this unity that inspired me when I came in the hall. A lot of people say that we drink to feel pleased and avoid pain. That's got to be ridiculous, really. Because I don't know of a group of people who deliberately suffered more pain than you and I did, you know, when we got into the problem stage of our habit. Some well-meaning people will tell us, well, you know, we submerged, or what they say, repressed the pain every time we went on a drunk and thought only of the good times. That's ridiculous, because I'm sure that you, just like myself, stashed away a few bottles to nurse that hangover or to pull ourselves through rough spots. Anyway, to speak for myself, I suffered. I had a rough time. I knew there was pain. And I knew there were high times, too, if I got a buzz on. But I was drinking for something beyond pleasure and pain, and that was unity. I got it together. When I started drinking, and now comes enough to hang my theme on, my personal story. When I first started drinking at 17, an uptight adolescent kid in school, and I got drunk one Easter weekend with three buddies. Nobody got hurt, no damage done. We got high. The sky was velvety and kind, and the stars were twinkling, and everything was beautiful. Just like the kind of thing you might hear Scott Fitzgerald talk about. Why not? Scott was one of us. So, you know, I had this beautiful thing going, and I thought, it's great. I'll drink some more. I'll find every occasion I can to get like this. This is great. I drank to feel good, to feel high, free and easy, kicks, laughter, fun, companionship, warmth. And that's how it all started. Now, what was the peculiar quality of the feeling good? Sure, I was pleased. You know, sure, I avoided pain. But there was something more important than both of those things, and that is that I got it together. I got it all together. The conflicting things going on inside me kind of melted and all came together in a unity. And the unity was something I felt in here, and I felt it with my buddies, the guys and girls that I was getting drunk with. I felt a nice kind of warmth. I'm sure that you, like myself, have gone through the period of the bar drinking and the party drinking, where you strike up an acquaintance who becomes the greatest friend in the world. And you go home and tell your wife when you wake up in the morning, groggy, sick, remorseful, and say, oh my God, Hilda, I met the best friends in the world I ever had last night, and I think they're coming for the weekend on Saturday. The frantic need for love and affection, huh? And we only could get that love and affection, I could, only by getting this sense of getting it all together, unified, together, in myself, with my fellow man. Happy, mellow, companionable. Then what happened as the thing went on? Well, I want to fill you in with a little of the story to bring you up to what happened to this unity. I was in those early days from 17 to about 24, what I call a booze artist. This comes out of our lingo over the years. I like the good old expressions of drunks themselves better than the textbook description. I was a booze artist, and by that I mean I was a drinker who enjoyed booze, who drank it so it would do certain beautiful things for me. You know, just some did it, took it for a dance, took it to meet somebody, took it at a funeral, took it at a wedding. You know, I did it for all of these reasons, made me feel good, and I did it with a certain amount of artistry. And I was an amateur drinker. And amateur, to me, in the best sense of the word, means anonymous, you know. I was a good amateur anonymous drinker. Then I lost my anonymity. I think I can spot it in my anonymity as a boozer. I lost that in the summer of 1934. I was at that time a Canadian citizen, youngster in college, on the east coast of Canada, and the little town we lived in was on a little ocean-going port, and I took off at 4 o'clock in the morning of June the 30th, 1934, with a good drinking buddy for England, in just the clothes I stood in. Now, by the time I sobered up, you know, we were steaming away past Newfoundland somewhere, and we were on our way. Now, it was a good voyage. The only thing that was rough about it was that this captain, Captain Markison, God bless him, Norwegian captain, was a very abstemious Lutheran. He's the only sea captain in my whole life that I ever met. You know, trusting alcohol is bad luck. That I ever met that would not serve or sell booze at sea. Because on the 1st of July, we went to him and said, "Captain, we'd like to buy a little booze, you know. It's Dominion Day in Canada, and, you know, we'd like to celebrate." And he stroked his beard and he says, "Oh, gentlemen," he said, "it's against my principles to sell alcohol. But," he said, "I'll make you a little present." So he gave us the measliest little bottle of claret I ever saw in my life. About so. There was about a mouthful each in it. So it was a very dry voyage, and an enforced kind of disgusting health was put upon me and Max. So we arrived in England in great good shape to go on a real good drunk. So the time we get back home, my anonymity shot all to hell. I'm now a marked drinker. I have lost my anonymity. I've lost my amateur standing. The family has me marked now for special lectures. You know, the man that I'm studying with in university cleared his throat when I met him that fall and said, "I hear you had a rather interesting kind of wet trip to Europe this summer." And, you know, the deed is out. I lost my anonymity as a Buddhist. And then, of course, after that, I entered into this next stage that I'm sure you'll all recognize with me. From having been a carefree, anonymous booze artist, I now become a booze fighter in earnest. And a booze fighter is a man who becomes a professional drinker. He has to find all kinds of supports and defenses to support his habit. First is the tissue of alibi that I, you know, put together. It was weird and wonderful. By the time I lost my commission in the RCAF, I had a list of 26 odd alibis that I used methodically and alternatively from time to time, because I discovered that smart bosses were always on to something as simple as the flu, you know. If you say after you've been out with the flu for the third time, that means right away you're on a drunk. So the best thing to do is to start using low back pain or fibrositis or something exotic like that. I had a list of about 26. And this is the support of alibis. Then, of course, there's the control. You know, the greatest delusion in the education of human beings, in my book, certainly has to be what people call willpower. Can you tell me, I'm not a great scholar, I'm a student who gets into things because of my interest. I'm not a great scholar, and I wish someone like that would explain to me how as phony an idea as this has persisted so long, willpower. I think the only reason I can find is that it has been something recommended to us by people who don't need it and who are too lazy to help us any other way. And they say, "Just, you know, pull up your socks, use some willpower there now, you know." And then, you know, we feel ashamed. We say, "Sure, of course, you know, every intelligent man and woman should have strength enough to put something down if he should." And, you know, then we feel very badly ourselves about it if we can't do it. So we keep the secret to ourselves. We who fail with willpower don't tell one another because we don't want to look like, you know, such weaklings. And therefore, the hoax is perpetrated generation after generation. This wild thing, willpower. I tried that. As I got deeper and deeper into trouble and the thing stopped being a joke after I lost the commission, you know, at a time in military setup when young men were truly ashamed about this. And I'm not saying that critically with relation to the feelings today. I'm just saying it was a different time and a different attitude toward things. And so I was beset with depression and remorse about losing this commission, and speedily got into the Army as fast as I could, even as a private. But you see, I went through some harrowing experiences with this booze thing now, and I was using patterns of control, willpower, going, climbing up on these painful water wagons, and then, you know, they'd break. And the longer the water wagon, the worse the drunk would be when I broke it. And I hadn't yet seen... I had yet to realize
that willpower failed because there's no habit to break. And I'll develop that a little more later. The clue, though, I'll give you to this, if you haven't already guessed it, the clue to the fact that we don't break the habit, I'm sure you'll see, in our step one. Here I am, my 25th and a half year in this magnificent fellowship, and I'm as powerless over alcohol this night as I was on November the 15th, 1948, when I cast in the ship. Just as powerless over alcohol, and my life is just as unmanageable. I stand here wired for booze or pills or anything addictive. I'm all set to go, just like that. All it has to be is plugged in, and I'm away. So you see, I haven't broken my addiction. I haven't broken my habit. The clue is in step one. I am, Dave, and I am an alcoholic. Not ex, not recovered, not recovering, an alcoholic. Oh, well, I mean, you're in good shape. Well, good shape for an alcoholic who's not drinking, I guess. Good enough. But I'm still an alcoholic. Let's get this thing very straight. So I haven't broken any habit at all. I like to believe that I've deepened and improved it. And that I'll go into a little. Anyway, I went through these years, like perhaps you did too, with spasmodic applications of willpower that snapped like old elastics, you know, every so often, and back into it again. I tried to rationalize it. I tried to get to the problem by science. By 1947, I had one wall of my little study lined and filled with books on booze and learned papers of all kinds and that I had studied. After I got into AA, I gave it all away to the library, the university library, for other people to study and find out how useless it was. Truly, you know, this is an act. This is not a thing out of books. And, you know, it takes quite a lot of courage for me to say that because I write books. But I really mean it. It's not a thing out of books. You can't learn the sobriety thing from books any more than you can learn tennis from a book. I like the story my old friend, Professor McMurray in Scotland, once said. He was explaining the fallacy of trying to learn things by reason. And he said, you know, I was a young man out of Oxford, and I decided I wanted to learn to skate. So he said, I went to the library, like the scholar I am, and I read all the books in the Dutch roll, everything that was going. And I went to the rink, and he said, I fell all over myself, nearly broke my leg two or three times. Finally, an old rink rat came along and said, here, young fella, give me your hand, and I'll show you the feel of it. I'll show you the feel of it. This is how we do it in AA. We show one another the feel of it in practice. Well, all right, you know. So then the willpower thing didn't work, and I was slipping and sliding all over the place. I got out of the army by the grace of God, good luck, without a dishonorable discharge. I made it just more by good luck than good management because I was developing the cunning of the defendant alcoholic. And then, of course, I reached the point, too, where the third phase of the booze fighting is this tremendous effort at self-importance. By God, I'll show them. So, you know, I'd get into a very bad spot on a rough drunk, and then I would overcompensate by splurges of work. And you know what would be so deceiving about this to many of us for a long time is that we perhaps would indeed show people with this extra splurge of work to carry us and give us a reason for another drunk and so carry on the addiction through to the bitter end. Now, what's happening to the drinking now, though? What's the difference in my drinking pattern here by the time I have this three sets of defenses, these alibis, this willpower thing, the science, and determination to be self-sufficient? With all these defenses now, how is my drinking differing from the way it was in the good old days? The difference is this, and it's radical. It's the opposite. I now, in this stage, am suffering the opposite of what I used to get when I drank for the hell of it. I now, you see, I'm alone where once I was companionable. I'm hooked where once I was free and easy. And I'm bored and fearful where once I was, you know, adventurous and partying. All of these things have gone into reverse, and yet I go on drinking. Has it ever stopped? Have you ever stopped to wonder, as I have many times, if you look at your drinking pattern, as we can easily examine and share this view together, have you noticed that as your drinking got worse, you drank more? As your drinking got worse and you got into more trouble, you didn't let up on it, really. Your drinking pattern really got worse. You know, that would be an insane happening if it weren't for a couple of truths that we come to learn about in AA.
And one, of course, is that fear always distorts the truth and makes the thing worse. We would drink again, you and I, would get into it again, in the hope, the desperate hope that this time it would be different and we would manage better and not get into so much trouble. Fear distorts the truth. And the most deceptive form of fear, I know, is the fear that makes you think everything is bright and attractive. You've been dry for a while, and you pass a bar, you've been dry 6 months, and there's money in your pocket, and that smell is tremendous coming out of the open door, and you decide, well, a few little drinks would be pleasant. It's a nice day. I've been sober all this time. And so the form that fear takes here is a vicious, deceptive form. It makes us feel that this is attractive and pleasant. I always recall the great words of the late Bill W. when he said, with regard to one binge he went on and started this way, was he and another fellow persuaded the pal that a few little drinks of Jersey Lightning never hurt no one. And so in this kind of spirit, you know, we slip over and over again. But now what is the thing I'm getting out of booze now? It can't be pleasure. How can it be pleasure? Here I was a partying type alcoholic, and here now when I'm drunk in this late stage, trying to teach at a university, I used to teach courses in philosophy. You know, one of my courses is a course in ethics, you know, of all things. Bright young kids are being instructed by this fellow on better ways to live. And so I'm on a drunk, you see. And how contrasted it is from the old ways of the old fun days. I turn the keys of the car over to my wife. The drapes are drawn. Somebody knocks at the door and she said, scurry upstairs, Dad, to the back room. You know, it might be the president or dean or somebody like that. And then the terrible feeling when my wife would admit some close friend. And we'd be sitting around the fireplace. And they'd be talking away like mature, sober people. And every once in a while, I'd make an effort to participate with a few drunken grunts. And then they would look at me and sort of pat me, patronize me. What's that now, Dave? You know, almost as though you were the pet dog. It's a hell of a feeling, you know? Sober people, non-alcoholics, I don't think realize the extent to which we are sensitive and alert to what's going on when we're drunk, you know? We can be very, very drunk, as I have been, and yet, you know, you can have tremendous stretches of lucidity, and you don't miss a thing. And it's a terrible feeling to be sitting in that chair like a little three-year-old, you know, making noises. And they're trying to be pleasant and patronizing. There, everything's all right. All right. What is happening here that, in contrast to the early days, it's unity. Half of the unity is shot because I'm out of touch with my own wife, with my friends. I'm completely out of touch. What form then does the unity take? Because we drink for it, I maintain. It's that sodden, passed-out unity. And you must know what I'm talking about. I hope I'm not saying anything shocking here to fellow alcoholics. The feeling you and I have when we're lying in that bed with the knees pulled up, curled up in bed, sodden out. Conscious enough to know that we're alive, but out of touch, the door is closed, we're up to go to the washroom and back into bed, sleep, wake up, drink, back again. Unity. Sodden unity. And that's why I say, you know, let's look interestingly and fascinatingly at this fact, that being sober has a lot of similarities to the drunken state. Difference, yes, or we wouldn't be here the way we are tonight. But don't neglect the similarity, because the similarity is going to make it easier to get sober and stay sober. The unity that I got from booze in those heavy drunken states, of course, can't compare with the joy of unity we know here. But it's the best we know how to get, and it's in the same class. There's so many things I'm discovering as the years pass in my sobriety, so many things in my drinking life and in those months that I was trying to get that I'm now getting in Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's no opposition, really, between the alcoholism and the sobriety, if we look at it in this light, easy way. Actually, I define an alcoholic now as a potentially sober person. Why not? Because if I said to you, my Aunt Nellie is sober this week, you'd probably say, my God, Dave, I didn't know the old girl had a problem. So sobriety matches alcoholism. They, you know, go together. They're in the same picture. Now, so I've taken you up to the grim end of my pattern. where, you know, there was really no joy. There was no fun anymore. There was a little dulling of pain. There was a little satisfaction of my craven, addictive needs. But the big thing I was aiming at, really, was the unity, such that my wife would quietly, in her best way, perhaps with the help of a friend, get me upstairs and into the sack, you know. And there to pass out, and the next day to resume the same thing, day after day after day, until you get so sick, you've got to sober up or die. So then this is the background of my story. And I went through, you see, the development of these three defenses, building the alibis and the excuses, working on willpower spasmodically and desperately and failingly, and, you know, trying over and over again to be resentfully and lonelily self-sufficient. So what happened? We come now upon what I call the greatest miracle of our program. I never stop marveling at this. I talk to friends who say, well, you know, after you're in AA for many years, it gets a little everyday and prosaic. And, you know, you know you must go and keep it up. But, you know, it's the same old thing, and we keep doing it because we know we need to. And we know that people who don't go to the meetings will get drunk and all of this. Let me try to convey to you something of the excitement, you know, from one person that's been at it for over 25 years. The excitement and the endless depth that are in this program. Because the longer I'm at it, the more fascinating I find it. Now, anonymity, you know. For me, anonymity is the miraculous key of this whole thing. Our fellowship, look at the steps, 1 through to 12. Look at the traditions, 1 to 12. Examine the slogans. They're as trite as rain. They're old-fashioned. They're solid as 2 and 2 make 4, but there's nothing new in them. Every gem of wisdom in our beautiful program has been stated by a Greek philosopher, by Jesus, by Moses, by Buddha, by historians, by great literary figures. You can find it in the whole history of thought. You know this as well as I do. That doesn't make it any less valuable that it's so solid and enduring and ancient. But, you know, it's really conservative material in a sense because it's so old and rooted and strong. The excitement of the program is what anonymity does to that wisdom. That's where the great news is, being anonymous. I remember years ago when I was first in AA, I had a governing position in everyday life, and one day I was downtown talking with these colleagues of mine in the government set up, and I was speaking about the need to promote alcohol programs, and then I happened to mention, just on the side, you know, a fantastic contribution that AA was beginning to make. Even then, 25 years ago odd. And this one rather cynical man said, well, to me, it sounds like the blind leading the blind. And then I remembered the lesson of AA, and to avoid the resentment, and I counted to 10 and said calmly, I said, that's exactly what it is. The blind lead the blind, and I understand today that in blind schools, that's the best kind of instruction is given this way. Blind people themselves teach the blind. But you see, the old cliche was, you know, this is impossible, it can't be done. You know, you've got to have an expert. You've got to have someone untainted by the disorder that will really pull someone out. And AA discovered this great truth. No, you know, the only one that can really help an alcoholic is another alcoholic who has learned how to be sober. So, anonymity, you know. Carter started out so beautifully here, you know, with the traditional way of stressing our anonymity to the press. I support that 100%. I've been in this fellowship too long to question it. It's a right that you have and that I have to respect this anonymity, just as he described. And we have found it valuable, chiefly, I think, to quell our fear, our own fear and the fear of society at large. We do live in a society that at many times is fear-driven, as we have witnessed on a national level just recently, all too recently. So, you know, this is true. The great wise people of AA in the early years saw that we're not going to encourage alcoholics to do anything about their problem by having them publicly announce it or go to a doctor and have it known through the community. No, we must make them feel, we must make alcoholics feel, the fellowship thought, that they can go to these meetings and become part of the fellowship activity, declare themselves to be alcoholics if they are, and have it all done very carefully and quietly anonymously and unobtrusively, and you slip into the town hall by the little eerie light at the back door, park your car in the other street. This is all, you know, still fine. It's great. There's only one amusing thing I think we can all share, and it's no lack of respect for that principle. It's just an amusing thing we can share. The people that we really knew we were alcoholics. The kind of capers you and I cut around town, wherever that was, you know, surely became known to anyone who had eyes to see. So, you know, while it's a great tribute to a fear condition and a good psychological move to make is to respect anonymity at this name level, let me share with you a deeper meaning that I wallow in. I think it's beautiful. And it's the meaning of anonymity that is given to us in the second and third steps after you and I have admitted at depth our powerlessness over alcohol and the unmanageability of our lives. We're saying in the second step that we come to believe in something else that we don't quite understand, but that we must believe in. Why? Because there is not a nameable institution in the world that we could have turned to help us. Everything that had a name said no. Everything that was unanonymous said there's no hope for us. So we had to come to believe, if we were going to have any hope in living at all and being so, we had to come to believe in something anonymous. And coming to believe in a power greater than myself, to me, is the biggest anonymous act of my life. Which has some relationship to hiding my last name, but not too much, perhaps. The big thing was that I had not found anything in society with a name, a form, an organization that could help me. The biggest men in that society told us that. Dr. Carl Jung wrote to Bill Wilson and informed him in a formal letter that I believe we have on record at headquarters, stating, you know, I appreciate and sympathize with this terrific condition of alcoholism, but nothing is known to science except alcohol. And nothing either, I'm sure, was known to religion. Because, you know, the pledge approach, and I was brought up a Presbyterian, I'm rather an unregenerate one now, but regardless of one state, there didn't seem to be anything in an organized church either that could turn the trick. I like to think the story about Pat took the pledge for about the 10th time. And Father Riley said, well, now, Pat, he said, if you break this pledge again, he said, I'm going to excommunicate you. So 2 or 3 days later, Pat's walking down the street. Father Riley's coming up, and Pat's cutting a pretty wide swath. And he says, make way, Father Riley, make way for a good Protestant. The pledge, which is another willpower, you know, ploy, never worked. And the church is well-meaning, reused it. And yet I think the conscientious clergymen are the first to admit of the rather gloomy success associated with the willpower ploy. So, you see, we have here a new technique that coming to believe in this power greater than myself is something that I'm not sure of yet. Most of it's anonymous. It's a power greater than myself, and no matter how thorough my religious background has been, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Mohammedan, or what, I am still very uncertain about God, because if you stop to think of it, most of them's anonymous, I think. I haven't yet met anyone that's on completely familiar speaking terms with him and knows all about him and his habits. I think that really the whole concept of God is the core, perhaps, of anonymity. Anyway, this is a very anonymous thing I'm doing in step two, because there's nowhere in the world that I can turn. Anonymous means without a name, a form, a professional gimmick. And, of course, there was nothing. So you and I had to take the second step after the admission of being powerless. And then I come to step three to really point up the wonderful, you know, value of anonymity for us. You know, the genius of the program is here in step three. I understand that the early members had it worked out that it would be to turn will and life over to the care of God, period. Then there was some kind of doubtful comments, I understand, from the San Diego area. And I believe Jim, and if I'm not mistaken, I met Jim a few years ago. And Jim very, very, you know, modestly offered the view that he was an alcoholic and wanted to be sober, but that he was an atheist, and at best an agnostic, that when he was thinking about God in any kind of way that made sense at all, it was pretty hazy and uncertain. So he said, gentlemen, how would it be, you know, if we rephrase that last part of the third step and made it God as we understand. What a stroke of genius. I can say I wouldn't be an AA. I'm quite certain that I wouldn't be an AA today if it weren't for that miraculous stroke of step two. God as I understand. Because you see, this God is changing. I find the longer I live and the more I learn, the more spectacularly God impresses me. So that what I thought he was in 1948 or 49 or 50 is not what I believe or feel him to be today. It's a growing experience, this notion, this feeling of what God is. And it's a beautiful anonymous sense. Because if I were to try to outline precisely what I believed him to be, you might accept it, you know, charitably from me as a belief. But, you know, you couldn't accept it as fact. Because I wouldn't know. I couldn't know. I can know how to behave and to be free and happy on the basis of beliefs that are strong and productive. But I cannot know for sure. So there's a strong feature of this anonymity, you see, in step two and three. Types of therapy come and go. They come and go. You know, there's one that's fashionable now, and it's growing great guns on everybody's lips. It'll be dead as a dodo in 5 years. Then another one will pop up, and that will go. Nothing quite is as corny and as old as a fashion that lives for a few years and passes. Why? Because they give themselves a name and a pretension and an organization that doesn't last. The beautiful thing about AA, our program, is we use words that we can all understand together. Each person, man or woman, can say it like he feels it personally, that's anonymously. And, you know, this is the way this great fellowship flourishes. I hope we never become organized. I pray to God we don't. Because it's in this tremendous, beautiful, informal setting that we get our freedom. So now, what happens in these three great steps? Some of my friends have complained over the years. They say, Dave, you know, when are you going to get into the other steps? Most of your talks are based on the first three. And yes, I confess that. These first three steps fascinate me so much that I consider the remaining steps from 4 to 12 pretty much a support and a deepening of 1, 2, and 3. And let me stress, you know, let me stress very clearly that steps 1, 2, and 3 will fall flat so far as sobriety is concerned unless we couple them with tradition 3, a desire to stop drinking. Because let me illustrate, and a little light humor here, let me illustrate how one can take those first three steps and still be on the booze. Actually, I think the reason I took to AA like a duck to water was I recognized something in the program when I came to it as a sober person that I'd been through drinking. Step one, for example. Admit the powerless over alcohol in your life unmanageable. I remember when I took that step consciously and deliberately and clearly. It was in September 1947, some 14 months before I saw AA. I had stopped the silly traffic from my den to the kitchen where the bottle of gin was. You know how you start drinking, you're going to drink like a gentleman or a lady, and you go to the sidebar and you pour it out and you go back. Then after the third drink, you just take the jug with you and plunk it down by your chair. And I'd reached the stage where I had my Gordon's dry just by the chair, and I remember one particular swing like this. And I took it away, and then I had that sensation of the shiver and the burn, as had an old Scott friend used to tell me about. He used to say, why is it, Dave, all these smart people in universities, they talk about causes and effects and rehab programs and what you do when you get sobered up. He says, nobody talks about the shiver and the burn. Nobody talks about the shiver and the burn. It's true. Not many writers talk about the shiver and the burn, what it's like to be drunk. So I put the jug down, and I have this tremendous, relaxed sense of unity. I take a deep sigh, and I say, I'll never stop drinking. I've been bugged a little by my good wife the day before, well-meaningly, by the boss, by a couple of friends, and I was anxious and nervous and upset about it. Now I was relaxed, you see, today. And I just shook my head, you know, in resignation, said, I'll never stop drinking. I had taken first step. I had taken the first step as an active drinker. That admission was an admission of powerlessness over alcohol and unmanageability of life while I was still drinking. Step two. I had a Very compassionate wife those years. God bless her. Sunday morning, I would awaken. Maybe 3 days drinking. Thursday, Tuesday, Sunday morning. Very dry, very sick. Very low. I could hardly get a word out of my mouth because my tongue would be stuck to the roof of my mouth. She'd be standing in the door and I'd say, duck, 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 duck. And she'd say, it's all right, Dad. I got a little bit of the hair of the dog. And she'd produce a nice little Mickey. Full. You notice when booze gets going down for an alcoholic, you never say a bottle's half full. You say it's half empty. But anyway, she'd have a little full junk. And I would just, you know, smile happily like a baby. Because, you see, this is the power greater than myself that was going to restore me to sanity. Step three, I remember clearly when I took that, I took step three many times, as you can see, but step three was a definite occurrence in my life. I went to the president of the university where I worked, and I requested of him that I cluster all my lectures around Wednesday and Thursday of the week. And he said, that's an unusual request, Dave. He said, can you tell me why? Good old con man, you know, talking about alibis, I had it all ready. And I said, well, you see, sir, the veterans need a lot of help. This is 1947, remember. 90% of the students in universities were veterans. So I said, you know, these guys need a lot of help and counseling. I was a student counselor, as well as a professor of ethics. Masters of hypocrisy, Andrew. So I said, yes, you know, they need this help. And he says, well, I did. That's very commendable. Of course, he said, but that's a lot of work, isn't it? I said, I know. That's a lot of work. But I said, I'm willing to undertake it for these poor guys. Now, these poor guys were great drinkers. And we used to have some fantastic dinners. And that's how we counseled over a bottle of scotch. See, I was living out what Oscar Wilde said so well, that, you know, work is the curse of the drinking classes. You can't drink professionally when you get along into the booze-fighting stage of alcoholism. And you can't pay too much serious attention to work. That's only an avenue through which you get enough money to buy booze. And the main occupation, if you're going to be smart, is to drink. Be a good drinker. So I was fulfilling this third step and the wisdom of Wilde at the same time, you know. Turning my will and my life over to the care of John Barleycorn, who was God as I understood him, of course. So then we can take a look similarly at the 12th step. You know, the grandiose feeling that I'd get, walk into a bar, maybe as a rebate from income tax. $75, $100, $150 in my pocket, and I'd walk into a bar, and of course the rationalization was all set. My wife didn't know about the extra money. There was food on the table. I had a long weekend. Well, of course, you know, I'll go in and treat my friends and counsel with them. So I would go in and, you know, drinks on the house. So what's the trouble there, Mary, George, Alice? Gather around. What seems to be troubling you? See, I was carrying the message to the alcoholic. So you see, my friends, we don't break our habits. I am doing step one, two, three, and four, and 12, and pot shots in the center. Not as well as I should, but I'm getting through them. You know, easy does it. I'm a good old con man because I'm a drunk. And I take too high to slogan, easy does it. And I'm hardly out of step three. I've done a little four and 12 and so on. But there's lots of time because the slogan tells me, you know, one day at a time and easy does it. And so, you know, I'm working along with this program with the same kind of God that I was. Drinking in many ways. Now there's some differences that are obvious that you know and that I know. And in a good talk, I think all that one can do is help us to recognize these things together. If I say something you don't understand at all, then, you know, I've blown it. So most of what I have to exchange with you is really something I'm sure you know, but we review it together and consolidate it. Now, when I go into AA, they teach me right off how to lose and to say goodbye to the defenses that have made me so unanonymous. And that's the supports and alibis that I'm talking about, the willpower and the controls and the manipulations, and the, by God, I'll show them self-importance thing. Step one helps me get rid of the support for once and for all. It's no good anyway.
I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable, and just at the completion of that step, I'm collapsed down to the earth where I ought to be, and I got it together. Because for years, with this control and this support thing that I had going, I was split and divided. I was trying to get it together by getting drunk, but as soon as I sobered up, the split and the dissension and the conflict is all back again. Now, step one brings me together again in the unity. I'm not much now. I'm pretty weak and helpless, and I'm no good. I can't drink, and my whole life is unmanageable. But in the puncturing of that prideful control, I at least get it all together, if only in a heap. I've got it together. It's the unity again. Step two helps me, you know, say goodbye forever to that control and keep it gone. Because if I have to turn, as I do and you do, to a power greater than ourselves, this means we're admitting that all capacity for control is shot forever. And goodbye, willpower. And the third, I cannot intelligently turn my will and life over to the care of God as I understand Him without getting rid of my self-sufficiency. The self-will goes, and in its place, there emerges something, again, very old-fashioned, but very meaningful and creative. And it's something quite we call the goodwill. You know, when I first went into AA, I had a tremendous time with this God concept of step two. And for many months, even years, I went on this. The God as I understood Him was this benevolent, beautiful, warm thing that I felt from you and you and you, my fellows in AA. And that, you know, breaks through the self-sufficiency, because I can't make this alone. Nobody can. And through step three, then, I get rid of the, you know, painful, lonely self-sufficiency. Now, there are four camps that make me anonymous and keep me anonymous. Four camps. There's a lot of talk today in the literature about the positive thinking and so on. There's a lot of creative meaning and some good, solid, negative things, too, you know. I've said time and time again over recent years that my freedom, and I believe the freedom of most people, is based not in what we can do, but chiefly in what we can't do. Because when we know well and deeply what we can't do, then we are really free to do ever so many rich, beautiful, wonderful things. What are the four can'ts? I can't drink booze or use addictive drugs. One. I can't blame my fellow man for anything. I can't expect anything of him or try to control him. And I must not try to withdraw and be self-sufficient. Four can'ts. Can't drink or use drugs, can't blame, can't expect, and can't withdraw. The four great tasks at the basis of our anonymous program. Now, you see why they make us anonymous? Because when I stop drinking and using drugs, and I'm not cutting up in the village pub and getting arrested for smashing up my car and getting my name in the paper for a fine and a stretch in jail, you know, being sober makes me anonymous and free and easy. And second, giving up the support means that no one's pointing the finger at me. My God, Dave Stewart coming down the street, I better cross over. He's going to put the finger on me for $20. You know, the need for support makes one very unanonymous. And then when we say goodbye to willpower, of course, that does, you know, tremendous things for the development of anonymity, because control is a self thing. Every kind of willpower thing, you know, or self, it's a self-control. It's always a self-enclosed thing. And it's very unanonymous, because when I'm talking about how strong my self-control is, I'm saying, I, Dave Short, am a person of very strong self-control. I'm making myself very unanonymous. Now, by contrast, what I use instead of the control in AA is discipline. And discipline is a very different thing from control. I cannot discipline myself alone. I need you. So you and I are together in this. You and I, you and I, you and I, in a group, in a fellowship. That is the way discipline flourishes. Discipline doesn't exist alone. Why? The word itself shows it. Discipline comes from the word disciple. And a disciple is someone who's devoted to something other than himself. And so therefore, it's through loving discipline that we make this and we abandon all control. You know, if you were to ask me as a member of AA, and even too, if I may say so, as a professional person, the greatest cause of all slips and relapses and well-meaning alcoholics, I would attribute it without hesitation to the problem of control. The old moral view has it that you and I are people of weak will and lack control. The opposite is the truth. Our most painful problem is over control. And the minute that you and I can let this whole thing just go and relax and melt into a fellowship together in a loving discipline, that's what really makes it. Giving up control is really where it is. The guys and girls that I know, there's a kind of a fun thing that we have going around our clinic now. We call it the well-to-do syndrome. That is, the people, you know, who have so much going in society, God bless them, that's wonderful. I wish I had more going, like they do. But they have a tremendous time, a lot of these people, with sobriety, because, you see, it's understandable. They think because they've achieved so much in a rugged, tough society, and it is that, but why the hell can't they beat this thing alcohol? By God, you know, or by themselves. And so, you know, it's very difficult, and they need a lot of understanding, these people, to realize they're just as powerless as the guy in Skid Row. Get that through their heads is the biggest thing for their recovery. You know, the acceptance of the loss of control at depth. And replace it. Make sure that falls a vacuum. Replace it with personal discipline. And then third, the loss of self-sufficiency introduces me to the tremendous experience of fellowship. Now this doesn't make you and me just leaning on one another. The truth is that you and I best find our meaning in fellowship. I equals you and me. This I've learned so well in recent years, and how true it is. Whenever I get into any trouble of any kind at all, this is what's happening. I'm isolating myself again. But if I get back in contact with you, I can cope. No matter how serious the problem is, I can cope with it if I get back in touch with you, my fellow man, especially if you're a fellow alcoholic. Now, I want to wind up this little theme about not breaking our habit. The only thing we change is that we stop drinking and using drugs. Everything else we accept and improve upon. Now, there are three things that I learned in drinking, three important things that I carry right into my sobriety. Now, I told you at the start of the talk that I drank to feel good. I'm sober for the same reason. Let me put it in a little more kind of idiom-like way. I drank to the hell of it, and I'm sober for the hell of it. You know, I deplore a lot of these good, well-meaning people. They mean well, and they're going to get sober now, and everything's going to be very serious, and no nonsense anymore, and no fun, you know. And I say, that's not where it is at all. If there's something you wanted to do when you drank, have the courage to do it sober, you know. Why do you need a middle man? If you're a spot like me, you begin to resent that terrible heavy price for the middle man that doesn't get you what you want anyway. And so, you know, I'm a great believer in fuller living. It's better to be fully than partially alive. And, you know, there's no reason why there should be denial of any kind, really, moving into sobriety. So we become sober for the same good reasons that we drank, and that is to feel good and feel free and relaxed. You know, another big mistake I find a lot of fellow alcoholics make, and non-alcoholics too. They think that getting drunk is an uninhibited act. And being sober is very uptight and inhibited and restrained. Friends, the opposite is the truth. I don't know about you. I'm here to tell my story. I can only tell you that years ago when I drank, in order to make some kind of score in certain areas, and I don't think I'll detail that, I think probably you can guess the kind of mischievous notions I might have in mind that seem to be great good fun. But if I drank to implement these things, did they come off as I planned? No, you know they didn't. And you know they didn't in your case, too. So, you know, how can we sit around and talk this old garbage over the years? Again, it's an old-fashioned thing that we just mouth because another generation has said it. It's time to look at the truth. No. Boozing the way we do inhibits our freedom and reduces us to sniveling, you know, sick people who must drink out of sick needs. You know, it doesn't liberate or free us. I wish there was an ad for every pelvic one I see, with a guy leaning against the fireplace in his dinner jacket, all shaved and in good shape. I wish you could see the guys I see every morning on my job, you know, when I go in to say good morning, Bill or George. Yeah, there's about an inch of beard here. And, you know, they don't look at all like this pelvic gentleman leaning against the fireplace. But in sobriety, if you get the right feeling for it, that you really want to be sober for the same good reasons that you drank, well, it's freedom and joy and fun, and do what you want. Get these things going that you wanted to when you drank. Only do them with finesse and skill now, and some kind of sense of beauty. You know, I'm very partial, as I study my things with people, very partial to what the old Greeks used to say. The Greek morality in the golden age of the Greeks. They would say about their idea of morality was, Nothing is really bad. The only unforgivable sin is that you do it badly. So that if there's something that you have in mind, seriously though, human desires have the right to be paid attention to. If you have a desire and it's part of what you are, look at it. Now, it may not be too wise to put it right into action, say the way Harpo Marx tried to, but to give it a little direction and finesse, there isn't any reason why you and I can't satisfy every basic human reasonable desire that may hit us. Or even if it seems out of whack, don't be afraid of it. Stop and look at it. Examine it coolly. See what it has to say. And then find perhaps another way of doing what it says. Not just what it says. You know, Freud said a good thing that every dream we have has two kinds of interpretation. There's the literal thing you dream about. Like you might dream you're passing a pretty girl going up a stair. And, you know, it's just that and no more. But then if you want to get really Freudian and introverted about it, you can make it mean something very much deeper than that, you know. Anyway, there's what they call the just what you dream about and then something else you give a meaning to at a deeper level. It's the same thing with a desire. When you and I have a desire to drink, it doesn't have to mean that it's a desire for alcohol. The meaning of that desire could be that I am lonesome and I need a friend as much as it does anything. You know, getting tired or lonely or isolated can actually make you physically thirsty. So let Coca-Cola do the physical job and do the real job at a personal level. There are all these ways you can handle anything that you want to do in a reasonable, accepted, moral way. So, I'm pointing out, you know, how the similarities here between the two patterns. I learned in drinking, too, that I could change the world for a while, you know, while it worked. I could change the world by changing me. I would go to parties, and I was a university student then, and I would listen to all this rather dull jazz that was taught us about the environment makes what people are. And as drinkers, I think you and I found out how false that is, really. Because I would go to a party, and, you know, things weren't too good in the environment. I knew that I could change that party for the better, not by getting, you know, to work on a dull, monotonous task of trying to change it. I just go up to the car to my glove compartment, pull out that Mickey and have three or four slugs, and I'd go back and I'd change the whole texture of the thing, the whole great new golden world now. I would change the party by changing me. I learned that when I drank, and I take it right into AA. John Dunlop told me years ago in New York. I'll never forget it. God bless him. He said, Dave, remember all through the years, there's no such thing as a bad AA meeting. Because if you're receptive for what's going on, if a talk is dull, like given by a guy like Stewart or something, just remember when you go out, when you say, I learned a lesson from that guy, I wouldn't go through all that jazz again. You know, no matter what it is, you know, you can learn from it. There's no such thing as a bad AA meeting if you, you know, make the decision and form the feeling within yourself. So we learn in AA, each of us, that great prayer. I always look for it around. That great prayer of ours, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept what I can't change, sure. And you know, I've made that belief just about everything in the world except me. I can't change you. I can't change events. I can't change the weather. So I must accept just about everything there is in this universe except one thing. Courage, change the thing I can, and that's me. And I can change me. So I take that lesson right from what I learned in alcoholism. Act right into my sobriety. Change the world, change life by changing me and my attitude. The third thing that I suspected when I drank, although I got into a great state of despair about it, but I wanted to love and be loved. And I'm sure you did too. I call alcoholism in some talks I give, I call it a love disorder. Because I think the thing that's hit the hardest with you and me in our life as drinkers and drug users is this capacity to love that somehow gets impaired. Something happens to us. And that's why this fellowship is so fantastically effective. It takes direct hold of that great need in the work and the play that we do together in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to love then and be loved, and that's what I want now. And so AA, this fellowship, gives me everything that I ever wanted out of drinking. So that's why I say we don't break our habits. We simply change one factor in it. I go into sobriety with the same intention that I had when I drank, to feel good. I have the same hope for outcome that I will in fact feel good. And the middle term is the only one I change. And that was, I drank booze or used pills now. I used the technique of anonymity as known in this fantastic fellowship. I can't begin to tell you all the things, my friends, that I would like to convey to you about my feeling in Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's done for me. This is my 26th year, and I'm still a babe in woods with so much of what there is still to learn. Don't let that be an obstacle. Just remember that you'll never be bored. You'll never be lonely. Because, like me, probably, you are a stranger in this great, beautiful fellowship took us in. Thank you, and God bless.